Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
It's River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In just a few days, as we've been hearing, a rare total solar eclipse will cut a roughly 100-mile wide path across North America. This time, though, Iowa not in the path of what is called totality, where it will get completely dark for a couple of minutes. Today, we travel back over 150 years to August of 1869, when Iowa experienced a total solar eclipse. Back then, the totality ran right across the state, from Sioux City to Keokuk. The event attracted the nation's premier astronomers to the Midwest. And that event is the central focus of a new book from my guest, its author, research astronomer Tom Hockey of the University of Northern Iowa. His book is titled America's First Eclipse Chasers, Stories of Science, Planet Vulcan, Quicksand, and the Railroad Boom. Tom is University of Northern Iowa Distinguished Research Professor of Astronomy in our Cedar Falls studio. Tom, welcome to the program.
Hi.
What did you set out to do in this book? Tell us a little bit more.
Well, I decided I would take this 3 minutes of Iowa history and dissect it and look at it from every point of view, which included all the local people in Iowa and the visiting astronomers, and it simply grew. It turned out that this was the event in the summer of 1869, more so than politics, which was unusual, more so than the laying of the Golden Spike, the Transcontinental Railroad, which we all read about in our history books.
Right, and that was completed in that same year. I think that Golden Spike, wasn't it, in Utah in 1869? Tell us about this eclipse. First of all, as an astronomer, August 7th, 1869, if I have the date right, tell us about it from an astronomer's point of view, its path and so forth.
Well, this was the first time that professional astronomers in the United States had launched a massive expedition to observe a total solar eclipse. They were usually living on the East Coast. And the idea was to go as far west as possible. Iowa became the ground zero, because this was the intersection of the eclipse path and the relatively new railroad lines. This eclipse, unlike before, it wasn't just people with a backpack and a telescope. They brought railroad cars full of expensive and delicate physical instruments. It could not have been done anywhere else.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit more about the state of astronomy at that time, the kind of astronomical equipment transported by railroad to Iowa.
Astronomy was on the verge of changing from the tradition of charting the positions of stars in the sky, physical measurements, to more physical experiments to try to learn about the nature of those stars and other objects in the sky. The professionals in the United States at the Nautical Almanac Office, the United States Naval Observatory, were well trained in the former kind of astronomy. This was their first attempt at the new astronomy.
Mm. A total solar eclipse occurs when the moon passes between the Earth and the sun, and it completely blocks out the face of the sun as the moon casts a shadow on the Earth, and those within the moon's narrow shadow experience what is totality, a total eclipse. How much did astronomers, of course, astronomers at that time knew about this, but how did astronomers, what did they know about solar eclipses compared to now? Were there big questions surrounding solar eclipses. Any difference there?
The total eclipse allowed astronomers to see the outer layers of the sun that are normally invisible because of the bright glare of what you and I think of as that yellow disk. And the nature of these outer layers was completely unknown. Some even questioned whether it was real or that it might have something to do with the moon and not the sun at all. The astronomers in 1869 set out to answer the question, what are those layers and what produces them? They didn't answer that question fully. That answer to that question is still ongoing.
Yeah. I'm looking at, and this is also interestingly at the advent of photography here in its infancy, really, here. And that plays a part in your book's narrative here. I'm looking at page, 64 now, where there is a picture of the totality on it. So talk about the state of capturing a solar eclipse at this time.
Photography still was new and not an easy task. One had to expose a glass plate that had been mounted in a camera at the end of a telescope and immediately process it. That meant that even before the eclipse was over, somebody had to be going through the chemical process to render an image. So not only did these astronomers set up temporary observatories for the telescopes, they also had to set up temporary dark rooms. And there were largely local professional photographers helping them out in this process, some of whom gave up actually seeing the eclipse, their first and maybe only opportunity in their lives, to turn those plates into photographs.
Mm-hmm. I'm looking at a page. You have so many archive photos in here that are interesting. This is what is noted as a temporary solar eclipse observatory in Ottumwa. And I was just surprised. It's such a big structure. So much of that structure would have been for developing photos? Or why did the structure need to be so big just to observe an eclipse for 2 minutes?
That's exactly right. Protecting the telescope, of course, for any bad weather that may occur. Turned out it was a lovely day. And very nearby, adjacent, attached, there had to be a dark room, which literally had to be perfectly dark, not allowing anyone inside any view of what was going on outside. And it took several people to go through the process of turning these plates into a permanent record. It was an assembly line process, and it was successful. The first good photograph of the outermost layer of the sun, the corona, was taken here in Iowa.
Mm-hmm. And so talk a little bit more about the mystery at that time surrounding the corona. We see some sort of licks of, if I can put it that way, of the sun. How do you put that? The exterior of the sun, right?
That's right, which is a very unusual sight if no one's seen it before, which was the case for these astronomers. These outer layers, what were they? What were they made of? What were their temperature? The astronomers based in Des Moines discovered what they thought to be a chemical element within the corona of the sun that had never been seen on Earth before. And that, of course, would be a major addition to our periodic table that hangs in every high school classroom. It actually wasn't. It turned out to be something more interesting than that. Already known element, but one heated to a fantastic temperature. Why should this thin outer layer of the sun be extraordinarily hot, hotter than the part we can see? And so they ended up enunciating a mystery that wasn't solved until more than 50 years later.
Mm-hmm. So how hot is the sun? And what do we know about that today? And how does that compare with what they knew then about the makeup of the sun, the different layers of the sun, how the sun creates so much heat and light?
That was a problem because in 1869, absolutely no one had any idea how something could be made so bright, so hot as the sun, and shine, which was becoming clear a very long time. Geologists were pointing out that the Earth was very old. It seemed like the Earth should not be older than the sun. What kept the sun going? It couldn't be on fire. That would have burned out or smothered itself very quickly. It wasn't shrinking. It wasn't until the 20th century and Albert Einstein that solved that particular mystery.
Mm-hmm. And so the most common theory, popular theory at the time, was in answer to the question of how can it burn without shrinking, without exhausting any fuel, was what before Einstein, decades before Einstein?
At this time, there was no other good suggestion other than, as you mentioned, that it might be very slowly compressing itself. But that would last for hundreds of millions of years until it was discovered that rocks on Earth were billions of years old. Mm. The astronomers, the American astronomers, went out to Iowa with pretty much open mind. Their intent was to measure whatever they could possibly measure in the hope that someone else would solve these mysteries.
Tom Hockey is with us in our Cedar Falls studio, University of Northern Iowa, Distinguished Research Professor of Astronomy. Fascinating book that he's written about, mostly about a total eclipse that crossed Iowa in 1869, America's First Eclipse Chasers. We'll be back with Tom Hockey in just a moment. It's River to River from IPR News.
Support for this IPR podcast comes from Iowa Community Foundations, an initiative of the Iowa Council of Foundations, connecting donors to causes they care about. Details on the Endow Iowa Tax Credit Program at communityfoundations.org.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
We're back with more of River to River from IPR News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tom Hockey is my guest for this portion of the program, University of Northern Iowa Distinguished Research Professor of Astronomy, talking about captured in his new book, a fascinating tale of a total eclipse, not from 2024, but from 1869, America's First Eclipse Chasers, Stories of Science, Planet Vulcan, Quicksand, and the Railroad Boom, taking us back to Iowa in 1869. Iowa had just been a state just over 20 years before, become a state. The country still recovering from the U.S. Civil War. We remember Confederate General Lee surrendering his troops in 1865. That would have been just 4 years before this eclipse. Also, as Tom pointed out, the final spike in the first transcontinental railroad completed in the spring of 1869. Tom, you write in your book how this total eclipse, solar eclipse, attracted the nation's premier astronomers. Also, there was one notable Iowa astronomer here with the impressive name of Gustavus Hinrichs. Who was attracted to Iowa to watch this total eclipse?
Specifically on Gustavus Hinrichs, He was an immigrant from Germany, of course, and he was teaching at the University of Iowa at the time. He is best known as the person who first studied derechos, which many of us in Iowa has learned about. So he observed this eclipse. But as far as professional astronomers, yes, they came from the various government agencies like the Coast Survey, and I mentioned before the Naval Observatory, the Nautical Almanac Office, all based in all city folk from Washington, D.C., and also some grand amateur astronomers, people who had made wealth in other lines and had devoted their later years to astronomy. This was still a time when an amateur astronomer could equip himself as well as a professional astronomer.
Talk a little bit about how, I'll just say, regular folk saw this eclipse at the time. How interested, how much press did it receive? What did you find in your research about reaction from regular people interested in astronomy?
Yes, about half my book involves just the people that you're talking about. All reaches of Iowa society wanted to see this eclipse from a amateur telescope set up on the grounds of the Benjamin Allen House, of course, which we now know as the residence of the Iowa governor. So watching amidst duck ponds and fountains, all the way to hucksters in the street who sold tickets to the eclipse, trying to make a few bucks off their rural brethren who had come into town. Basically, they were selling the sky, though admittedly they did say that there was no refund on account of weather.
Of course, traveling much more time intensive at that time, not like today where, and I understand you're going down to the eclipse in a few days, but was there a lot of traveling, or was it mostly, I mean, aside from the astronomers from out east, did people flock to Iowa to any degree?
This was the beginning of eclipse tourism. The railroads ran special cars from cities just outside the path of totality to where people could see the total eclipse. At least one was equipped with its own brass band. I know this because the professional astronomers set up just outside the railroad station were trying to communicate with each other, and all of a sudden, during the eclipse, there was this huge noise that they didn't care much for. Most of the people who observed the eclipse, though, still were people from Iowa, where the path crossed over. Everyone in the state saw at least a partial eclipse. And I just became very interested in the range of reactions that average people had to this celestial event.
Mm-hmm. And the range of reactions, they also how to safely view it. I think you have in the appendix some instructions from the time how that were way off, that you could have injured your eye with. People didn't necessarily know and weren't told how to safely view this, be it a partial or a total eclipse, were they?
The standard way of filtering one's eyes at the time was to light a candle and use the smoke on a piece of glass. While this made the sun look dimmer, the harmful ultraviolet infrared rays from the sun went right through it. And it is rather amazing that no one was blinded. Sadly, one woman was a eclipse fatality while she was smoking a piece of glass. her long dress caught fire.
Oh my!
And she died.
Hmm. And she was trying to make this smoky glass, and then that fire accident happened.
There, as far as the visiting astronomers go, no one handling all this equipment and going to places that they weren't used to and stuff. It's sort of surprising. The worst injury was a case of eczema. However, astronomers from Quebec, making this an international affair, the lead astronomer there might have lost his life in inspecting a perfect eclipse viewing site. He slipped into quicksand, he and his horse, and narrowly escaped.
Where was that? Where was the quicksand?
Near Jefferson. And his report on the eclipse is an adventure story. Interestingly enough, he did not consider the quicksand episode to be his worst experience.
I didn't know
he
there
thought
was,
it was the mosquitoes.
I didn't even know there was quicksand in Iowa. I guess we have all these. There's all the tiling now underneath a lot of our land. So there was quicksand. Maybe there still is. I don't know.
While it may not have been technically so, that was the word that he used.
I see.
Yes, his horse and nearly him with it sank into a bog. He put up with all these trepidations to take photographs of the sun during an eclipse, and then, though he would never admit it, trip over the camera in the process, ruining the photograph.
Mm. Tom Hockey, my guest, if you've just joined us, University of Northern Iowa Distinguished Research Professor of Astronomy, talking about an eclipse, a total eclipse that crossed Iowa in 1869, the subject of his book, America's First Eclipse Chasers. We have to get to talk about Vulcan. For a very little while, it was thought that here in Iowa, a new planet was discovered orbiting the sun. This is a hypothetical planet, Vulcan. Of course, most of us connect Vulcan with Star Trek now. Tell us that story.
I think the TV show borrowed the name. Yes, Vulcan was the made-up name for an imagined planet that orbited supposedly very near the sun. The existing of Vulcan would have explained a irregularity in the orbit of the planet Mercury. So one of the goals of this eclipse was also to search for this planet. With the bright sun blocked, it would no longer produce glare, and you might be able to see something that was very close to the sun. It was not, however, any of the professional astronomers. It was a group of amateur astronomers in what is now Lemars who had a credible enough discovery that it was featured in the premier science magazine of the time, Nature, as the big outcome of the 1869 eclipse. We now know there is, in fact, no such thing as Vulcan. The irregularity in Mercury's orbit had to do with something entirely different. But wouldn't that have been something if on a farm in Lemars or near Lemars, what would have been at the time the ninth planet in the solar system was discovered.
Yeah, that would have been fascinating. Some Americans saw this event in 1869 as having great religious significance. Talk about that aspect you discovered in this research.
We're provided with an incredible scene on a roof of a building in Mount Pleasant. Professional astronomers on one side with their telescopes and other instruments, and on the opposite side, a group of Iowans, donned in what they called their ascension robes of white, who were awaiting the rapture to take place during the eclipse. Quoting the Bible, the sun became as dark as cloth. It did, of course, not happen. I don't know if they were disappointed or relieved.
What other surprises did you find in researching this event? Did it take you several years to research this 1869 eclipse?
It did, with large gaps in it. I did not even know that this eclipse had taken place until it literally came to my doorstep in the person of the director of the Nautical Almanac office in Washington. He asked me if I was aware of the 1869 eclipse. I said no. Was aware that that path went through, the edge of that path went through my hometown of Cedar Falls. No, I was not. He was on a tour to remeasure the locations people reported seeing the eclipse and where they did not, using then-new GPS technology to better characterize our knowledge of the position and size of the sun. So we spent an interesting afternoon around Cedar Falls trying to find these locations. The town has changed quite a bit since then. Mm-hmm. But one of those locations was in the cupola of the orphans' home, which turned into my own university, the University of Northern Iowa.
Hmm. I wonder, in doing this research, of course, today in the 21st century, we have so many things that are awe-inspiring from our technology and so forth. But we go back to the 1800s, there was less of that. But I wonder if you can give us an idea of the mindset of the people back then and what this seemed like to them. I know you have witnessed numerous total eclipses. Do you know what I mean, Tom? Is that we are used to being wowed these days, and in that time, perhaps not as much by something as impressive, awe-inspiring as a total solar eclipse?
Well, let me address it this way. Of course, reports were written upon professional astronomers' returns. As you might guess, astronomical reports in professional journals are somewhat dry normally. But in almost every case, in the midst of their numbers and calculations, each one felt compelled to actually describe the total eclipse at it itself. And apparently, well-laid plans in many cases went out the window. They just stood with their mouth opening, watching this. And the prose is worthy of anyone else at the time, Whitman or Twain.
Hmm.
It's actually enjoyable reading, believe it or not.
And the difference between witnessing a partial and total eclipse, tell us about that, because even 99% coverage is not good enough for the real awe-inspiring event, is it?
That is right. A total solar eclipse is a visceral experience. Both the environment around you, the sky changes, and of course this dark spot surrounded by a strange amorphous glow. A partial eclipse is interesting too, because something very familiar to us, the disk of the sun, for a few hours at least, changes, but the total eclipse is the gold trophy winner among eclipses.
Tom, we have just a minute or two left, but you'll be traveling to this coming total solar eclipse in the South?
My students and I will be going. Actually, we're going to Indiana. And the fact that there is a total solar eclipse so near Iowa is something we don't want to pass up, simply a day's drive. Listeners might question my use of the word near, but considering a total solar eclipse can occur anywhere from Antarctica to the middle of the ocean, that it passes through the Midwest is certainly something we want to take advantage of.
Good luck with that. And what does the weather tell you at this point?
A little early so far. Forecasting clouds is particularly tricky. The conventional wisdom is that as one goes south on the eclipse path, the chances should be better. This one, it looks like it might be the other way around. They're having some storms down in Texas.
Okay. Tom Hockey, thank you for coming into our Cedar Falls studio. You and I, Distinguished Research Professor of Astronomy, his book, America's First Eclipse Chasers, Stories of Science, Planet Vulcan, Quicksand, and the Railroad Boom. Tom, what a delight to speak with you today. Thank you.
Enjoyed it. Top of the hill, river to river, Ben Kiefer. All right.
Take care. Bye now, Tom.
Bye.
After a short break, we'll be back with more of River to River from IPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Ben Kiefer with River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. Today, you're listening to an encore edition of the program. Well, let's have some dark fun in this portion of the program and venture into a post-apocalyptic vision of our country. Let me start by reading from the back cover of a new graphic novel. Who will stop the country from destroying itself? This is a story about courage, about a hero who will rise from the wastelands and unify the people, about the war between decency and fear. Reading from the back cover of a new graphic novel titled 2184 and a Half. The co-authors join me in the studio now for this portion of the program. Artist Thomas C. Jackson. His works have been exhibited in many national and international juried exhibitions. Also writer Fritz McDonald, the author of many works of fiction. He is also a graduate of the University of Iowa Writers Workshop. Tom and Fritz, welcome to our program.
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
I enjoyed this book very much, seeing how you took the themes from the present day and spun them out in themes that worry us, most of us anyway, spun them out into a very frightening future with some warnings. I think that's probably the intent behind some of this. Which of you would like to set the scene for this? What is America like in the year 2184 and a half?
Well, I'll get started with that, Ben. Mm-hmm. In the past years, just looking at the politics in America, particularly in 2016, we saw people talking about all kinds of things, denying climate change, for example, and building border walls and so forth. And there were just a lot of things that were going on. People wanted to reduce the number of departments in the United States government, for example. And we thought, what would happen if all of these kinds of things continued for 150 years and all of what was happening was exacerbated over time? And so we ended up with an environment where there were many fewer people because there had been pandemics and other things that happened and reduced the number of people. And government really wasn't government as we know it today. There were just powerful people who were wealthy, and the country had been split up into tribes.
And these powerful people have a name. They're called the Ones.
That's right.
Okay. So to quote from one passage in your book, and you have a picture of North America, of the U.S. here, but to give kind of a mind's eye view of this, from your book, the livable landmass that made up the most powerful country in the world shrunk radically. It was broken up into small states that were reshaped into peninsulas, archipelagos, and islands known as the deconstructed states of America. You called what was happening the Great Reshaping, Fritz.
The Great Reshaping was both a physical reshaping of the country, so it shrank the country tremendously. We guessed wrong about how far the waters would rise, but we also guessed wrong about how bad politics and democracy would get at the same time. The whole place is broken into tribes. It's run by the ones. The ones are a malevolent group who are not entirely competent, but they're evil. I heard someone say once that Stalin was a fanatical, evil leader, but he wasn't an entirely competent dictator, and I like that idea. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to bring up that there's also some humor in this depiction of the world.
And it's at a time when we're have very real concerns that might have seemed laughable to many of us just 10 years ago, concerns about becoming trending towards a more authoritarian rule in this country. So in this book, The Ones, how did The Ones come to power?
Well, they rose to power just by simply descending from the ones that are in power today in one way. There's this long line of dissension over several hundred years going forward. And they also came to power by being owners of massive corporate conglomerates and things like that. The phenomenon that we have today, I think, which is a little bit different than, say, 40 years ago, is that we have people who are rich, and then we have people who are a whole lot more richer than just your average rich person. And it's the whole lot more richer category that worries us a little bit. So what we tried to do is we tried to take that category and turn them into this entire group of people who are going to rule everything, you know, in a so-so fashion.
They also came to power by controlling the environment, for one thing. They intentionally shrank the amount of space where people could live, and they isolated people and so that the people couldn't interact, and they had a lot of fake news. And they were telling people what they wanted them to believe, and people over time came to believe it.
Also, another passage from your book, this is from page 40, The Ones rewrote the Constitution, got rid of checks and balances, isolated the population. Naturally, others rose up against them, artists, writers, performers. That's a setup for our hero, our protagonist of this post-apocalyptic story, Amanda. Tell us about Amanda. Also, her appearance, because I think that's a big part of this, and there have to be reasons behind her appearance. Comment on Amanda.
Amanda was a character that we thought about an awful lot. And actually, when we began conceiving the book and began drawing, the figure looked different. We wanted just a real average, common sort of looking person. And after a period of time, we thought, no, it would be better if this were an entirely new looking person. And so she was an orphan who was raised by a tribe of motorcycle people. And the entire tribe has face tattoos. So Amanda has a very distinctive face tattoo. And her hair, instead of falling down to her shoulders, sort of rises up and has a turned-up nose. She has a very distinctive look.
And I don't want to have a spoiler here, but she does have, I don't think it's telling too much to say that she has special powers. And so there's a quest for finding out what are these special powers, some of them undiscovered until later in the book, and why she has these special powers.
Yeah, she, at the beginning of the story, you know, we discover that she's with a group called the Tooth Riders, which are this biker group that, even though they look like big, bad, tough guys, actually do a lot of compassionate work for the communities around them. And she's been raised by them, trained to be a mechanic, and she's a very skillful young person. And she was found on the banks of the Rio Grande. She's got this mysterious past. So she's got a couple of reasons for going out in the world, one of which is to find out her origins, her identity. You know, who was she? Where did she come from? And how does that tie in with the ones? The other reason is that she's been in the Southwest her whole life. So when she starts out on her journey, she hasn't seen the country and the devastation that the ones have wreaked upon it.
Yeah. And very early on, Amanda finds a dying man in the desert. And this is our first clue I had anyway, that there's something special about Amanda. This dying man in his last dying breath says what to her?
You're the one.
You're the one.
Yeah.
And she joins a troupe of performers. And this is interesting because it's, what, performers? How are they going to battle the ones? Talk a little bit about this troupe that she joins, and she's also puzzled by the group as well, right?
Mm-hmm. Initially, yeah. She goes to Wichitoma, which is what's left of, you know, two places, and discovers the performers, discovers the entertainers, which run the place. These are the women that she falls in with are a group of women who do a kind of cross between, you know, burlesque and a kind of performance art at the same time. Actually, this was one of the most fun sections we had drawing it.
Right,
we tried to figure out the performances.
Right, and Amanda objects at the, or does she object? She's like, you want me to be a stripper? You're strippers?
Yeah, initially that's what she thought. And they said, no, we're a lot more than that. The way they fight the ones, and their shows are all for the audiences of the ones, you know, all over the place. The way they fight the ones is they're actually gathering intelligence on them. Mm-hmm. So they're a leading point of what turns into the resistance going forward in the book.
Yeah, there's so much in here we don't have time to talk about. I wanted to talk about some of the themes that you address here, important themes for our times. One theme, anti-science, attitudes in our society. I'm looking at the two of you. We're in approximately the same age group. Mm-hmm. This has risen in our lifetimes, false claims, and you have them in the book. Why, really ridiculous claims. Why fracking is good for groundwater? Coal, a renewable resource. Talk about the anti-science theme here that you spin out.
We wanted to tie the anti-science theme in with the sort of corporate agenda of the ones behind them. So the ones want to keep doing fracking. So what they're going to do is they're going to spread disinformation about the science of fracking to people, so on and so forth. And they've created this foundation and sort of institutionalized this, not only anti-science, but a ridiculously stupid anti-intellectual point of view,
right.
Which it's funny and it's kind of exaggerated there, but this is something that we've been confronting. It's really come out in the open in the last 4 years.
Yeah.
I'm stunned by people who wouldn't get a vaccine for COVID.
Well,
who didn't trust it at all, who said that people are lying about this, you know, that science is wrong. I'm stunned whenever anybody says, I don't believe in science.
Right.
I think it's not a religion, you know.
Right. And this rise of so many people in our society trusting hosts on cable TV something when they make really easily refutable claims, false claims, they believe these sorts of people with big names over those who have studied for decades in very specific scientific fields. It's just mind-blowing.
Yeah.
My guests, Tom Jackson and Fritz McDonald, co-creators of the new graphic novel titled 2184 and a Half. I have to ask, why the half if you said it 150 years in the future?
Well, there was a couple of reasons for that. We wanted people to immediately think of George Orwell's 1984,
mm-hmm.
and for them to understand that this is a book about the future. But also, the ones had decided that instead of going from year to year, going to 2185, for example, it would just be 2184 and a half forever. That way, there would be no more elections. They would stay in power in perpetuity.
That's right. And this was a mechanism to and the ones actually freeze time. They just love it the way it is, right?
Yes. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Want to freeze everything. And so actually they actually freeze the year in 2184 and a half.
They do. And they love the current time, but they also love the past. And there's a section in the book where our hero visits, and everyone is play-acting as if it's the 1950s and 1960s and reliving events from those periods.
Yeah, that's a wonderful part of the book because it takes nostalgia to a ridiculous extreme where it doesn't make sense anymore. Of course, we all enjoy our past and nostalgia, but it can be, as you see in this, misused, I guess, is a way, and the ones are misusing it here. Let's talk a little bit about how you work together to create a novel. This is a graphic novel. I had to put my brain in a different sort of mode, reading a graphic novel different than a conventional novel. Talk about that and how you work together to mesh the narrative, the words, Fritz, and the artistry of yours, Tom.
I actually had the concept to do 2184 and a half, and I began doing some drawings. I had an idea of places where the hero would visit. And Fritz and I had been friends for many years, and we started talking about it, and we decided to collaborate. And so we spent about a year actually meeting once a week and talking about it and developing an outline for the book. So we knew things that would happen in the book. And then Fritz began writing the script, and as he would get a section of the script written, I would take the script and then begin illustrating each of the pages.
This reminds me of a lyricist and a composer, a bit.
Kind of, yeah.
Very much.
Yeah. And things would change. I mean, I'd hand him a section of script, and it could alter according to how the visuals worked out, mm-hmm. in the same way that it does with the songwriting team or when you're filming a movie, mm-hmm. where things have to adjust when you suddenly see what you're...
And early on, when he would give me the script, and I would show him what size those words would be, how much space that would take on the page, he would realize, oh no, I've got to cut that down.
Right.
Yeah.
So we went back and forth a lot there, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah.
You had to make it succinct. Who's the audience for this book?
I think it's really interesting, as we've been to book signings for this and given talks about it, we've talked to people of all different age groups. One thinks that the audience for graphic novels is very young, but we've had people of all ages and had a good response from people of all ages.
We did a reading at Prairie Lights, and I was pleasantly surprised by the number of students that came up afterwards to talk to us, yeah. Young students.
Mm-hmm. What is the appeal of dystopian fiction? I just reread one of my favorites, The Road, Cormac McCarthy, here. I don't know why I'm drawn to it. Can you explain that? You must see it in yourselves.
I think dystopian fiction is a mirror of, you know, trends or phenomenon or sociocultural events that are happening right now. I mean, I think a lot of great science fiction is predicated on the idea of I'm going to take something from the present and I'm going to turn it into the future so we can kind of reflect and look back on it in a different mm-hmm. lens mm-hmm. going forward.
Can that be successful in delivering warnings to the present day?
I think so. I think one of the things that pleases me most about today is that science fiction has gone through this renaissance again, and that we're elevating writers that we ignored, like Samuel Delaney, you know, many years ago, who are fantastic writers and had fantastic visions. I think people are really responding to the dystopian.
Tom, as we finish up this conversation, what are the takeaways you hope readers will keep in their minds after they've thoroughly enjoyed this graphic novel and been amused by it at the same time by being frightened by it, as I was?
Well, I hope that they will have enjoyed the story. It's certainly something that you can read without thinking about politics and so forth. But if you are somebody who thinks about politics, I hope that they think about the future and think about the present. And as they vote, as they go about their daily lives, that they'll think about what kind of future they want.
Right. And there are words here for individuals. One of the themes we didn't really touch on is our dependence on digital devices. We're just kind of glued to those, and you take that to an extreme as well, don't you?
Yeah, we created a land. A lot of what you do in a dystopian fiction or a graphic novel is you do world building, and one of the parts of the world that we built was called Virtualrama, a place where technology is completely out of control.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, that's all the time we have for today, unfortunately. Plenty more that I'd love to talk to you about, but we've run out of time, and I just remind us, those who may have just joined us, Tom Jackson with me and Fritz McDonald, co-creators of a new graphic novel titled 2184 and a Half. Well worth the read. It's entertaining, scary, cautionary, all those things and plenty more at the same time. Tom and Fritz, thank you for coming into our studio today.
Thanks so much for having us. Yeah.
River to River Today, produced by Caitlin Troutman and Samantha McIntosh. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.